In El Paso, high school students reflect on last week's massacre.
We push for positivity. We push for being open arms to everybody. We push for supporting each other. Everything that we pushed for, it was just all knocked down.
I'm Marco Werman. Also, a generation of Russians has only known life under Vladimir Putin.
He's a judo master. He's a judo champion.
And today, the judo master has been in power for 20 years. To mark the celebration, protests in Moscow, but not because of Putin. Activists are upset about municipal elections. And a UN official talks about how to regulate hate speech.
We're confused about who should be responsible for regulating that content. Should it be the companies or should it be government?
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We begin today in El Paso, 6 days ago, the site of another mass shooting in America. A gunman at a Walmart took 22 lives. Later that night, 10 more people were killed when another shooter opened fire in a popular area of Dayton, Ohio. Today, President Trump said it's time for action. He said we can do very meaningful background checks and that Republicans would lead the charge. Trump also said Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was totally on board with his plan. McConnell, an ardent supporter of gun rights, says the issue will be front and center when Congress reconvenes in September, but that he has not endorsed any legislation at this point. The shootings have been a lot for all of us to take in. The El Paso shooting has been especially hard for schools there.
My name is Jose Espinosa, and I'm the proud superintendent of the Socorro Independent School District.
My name is Tammy McCabin, and I am the director of school counseling for Socorro Independent School District.
I am Daniel Gutierrez, and I am the proud student body president at Motwood High School here in El Paso, Texas.
We spoke with all three in a break between classes. I asked them to share some of their reflections on the week.
You know, we're a border school district. We have over 47,000 students. 92% of our kids are Hispanic. And to be frank and honest, you know, when you have somebody drive from Dallas, Texas, which is about a 8-hour drive, some of our parents, some of our employees, some of our students, you know, they feel that we may have a bullseye on our back because we would have never, ever thought that this would happen in El Paso.
Daniel Gutierrez, you're a student, as you said, at Montwood High School. How are you doing right now? How's this week been for you?
It's hard for us younger kids. On Friday, the day before the event, here at Montwood, we hosted our senior sunrise and we played games. We called it our first Montwood High School social. You know, it was a happy day. It was a day people would remember. And to wake up the next morning to tragic news that, you know, we probably would have never imagined happening here, it was hard. We pushed for positivity. We pushed for being open arms to everybody. We pushed for supporting each other. And I feel like it was just all knocked down.
You're the student body president. I know you organized a vigil this past Monday. That's just 2 days after the shooting. What was it like organizing that vigil? Like, did students want to be together?
So the day of, students were messaging me, telling me, you know, we have to put something together. We have to put something together. We put together a vigil. We rang 20 bells, and we released a balloon for every bell for the 20 lives lost, because at that time we were only aware of 20 lives. We weren't sure about how many students we were going to get. It was open to only our faculty, staff, and students. And when we saw students walking in, when we saw teachers walking in, you know, it's silent. They're head down, some are crying, and that's when I took the opportunity to really push for just the future generation setting the right example, the future generation spreading positivity within each other.
Tammy McCabin, you're director of school counseling for the Socorro School District. What are students' biggest needs? What's the most important thing counselors can give kids in El Paso right now?
I think the most important thing right now that counselors can give students in El Paso is just reassurance, just knowing that they have someone to talk to at any time. Our counselors are available all throughout the day, and we know that we have a wonderful community of resources as well. We have given our students and our parents a hotline from one of our local counseling agencies that it's a 24/7 hotline, so students can call at any time. Anytime if they wake up in the middle of the night and they're scared, they can call, because we want our students to know we're here 100% of the time for you to help you. And we're going to be here today, tomorrow, next Friday, at the end of the year. We're going to be here always to talk to the students even though the world is going to go on and everything's going to go on in our district, we know that this is something students are going to want to talk about and we're going to be there for them.
Daniel, as a student, you're dealing with all of this, of school shootings and now shooting targeted at Latinos. Are you and other students talking about this? Like, what have those conversations been like this week?
As a student leader, I try to refrain from those conversations because our generation usually tend to look at the negative aspects. And, you know, I'm not about that. I'm not. You know, I remind students that it's important that we speak up. It's important that we use our voice. It's important that we use the platform that we have, which is social media, to spread positivity. And I reassure students that it shouldn't be about us being scared, that whatever they want to see in this world, it's important that they react and they take action for the future.
I understand the need for people to focus on positivity. Jose Espinoza, let me ask you, I mean, the shooter was intent on targeting Latinos. I mean, how do you, as head of the school district, deal with that reality?
You know, at all times, you know, we need to communicate openly and consistently with all of our stakeholders, our students, our employees, our parents. And we must provide reassurance that we, as a school district, we're here to protect and serve their children no matter, you know, where they come from. And we need to ensure they know we are here for them and that our schools are truly, and I truly believe these are one of the safest places that they can be, you know, and we must show, you know, that our parents, that our actions will speak louder than our words. So, you know, if I would have to tell other colleagues, you know, and peers, I would tell them, you know, use all means available to them to communicate with their community, because that right now, this week and next week, that is what our community right now is thirsty for. They want reassurance. They want peace of mind that I can send my little 5-year-old, my 10-year-old, my 13-year-old to school, and he's going to come back home physically safely and also emotionally safely as well. And I think that's been one of our big focuses here as a school district, and that'll continue to be the focus of our school district this year and moving forward.
I mean, only into the second week of the school year, I imagine security, it can be a big distraction as the school year begins. Have you had people who are worried and they don't want to send their kids to school?
You know, to be honest with you, Marlo, there have been some kids who were directly impacted by this tragedy, who were there from a soccer team fundraising, you know, for their soccer team. They have not returned to school. And there's a little girl who was there who returned to school the next day. We're giving every family, every student, we're respecting the time, but we're reassuring them that we will be here for them.
Daniel Gutierrez, last question to you. The weekend's coming up. What still weighs on your mind? Or are you coming up with weekend plans to distract you?
I know this weekend, you know, it's not easy to just go out. We're planning to going as a family to go visit the memorial of where the event happened, because it is something that we were all impacted by, whether we were impacted firsthand. You know, it happened in our community. And I think it just helps us accept, you know, everything that happened and just take in the lives that we should be remembering.
That's Daniel Gutierrez, a senior at Montwood High School, also its student body president. I was also speaking with Tammy McCabin, director of school counseling for the Socorro School District in El Paso, as well as Dr. Jose Espinoza, the superintendent of the Socorro Independent School District. Thanks to all three of you for being with us today and for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today marks the 20th anniversary of Vladimir Putin's hold on power in Russia, a generation now that has known only Putin. Coincidentally, Moscow is in political crisis, protests, mass arrests, a police crackdown, not because of President Putin, at least not directly. It's happening because of local city elections. Scores of opposition candidates were barred from running for local office by the Moscow Election Commission. When I was on assignment in Russia back in May, I spoke with one of the candidates who's now being denied the right to run for office. Her name is Lyubov Sobol, and she has now emerged as one of the leaders of this protest movement. Reporter Charles Maines has been following the story closely and joins us from Moscow. You were actually translating for me, Charles, when I met Lyubov Sobol in May, but a lot has changed since then. What have the last 3 weeks been like for her?
Well, you know, as you noted, she was blocked from the race. This was by the election commission here over what they say were fake signatures. Now, the catch, it wasn't just Sobel that was blocked. It was every independent candidate. We've had protests the last two weekends in a row. Crowds were out in significant numbers, but maybe more notable for the fact that there were mass arrests. We had 2,400 arrests over the last 2 weeks. Ms. Sobel is actually on a hunger strike right now. She's been arrested twice herself. Her colleagues are in jail. So, yeah, it's been quite the last few weeks for Ms. Sobel and for Moscow in general.
Yeah, somewhat extraordinary developments. And just today, Charles, you had a chance to speak with Sobel during a press conference. What did she have to say?
Well, she was there to unveil a list of demands. She's asking for access to the ballot, of course. She's also asking for freedom for those who've been imprisoned on what they say are politically motivated charges. But, you know, you get the sense that she knows this is about more than just the city government elections. And I asked her, well, why the heavy response? And her answer, you know, they want to scare people into staying at home. And let's listen to what she has to say. So she's saying here that authorities want to dampen down the protest, but their approach out of habit is to use the security forces. So they're trying to scare people from coming out, but in fact, people are going out in the street not because they want to, but because they have to express their rights and defend them.
One of the big questions is, why are these protests so big and why are authorities reacting so violently to, you know, local city election protests?
Yeah, it's really the big mystery here. It's summertime in Moscow. Basically, everyone's out at their dachas, at their summer cottages, or traveling. No one was really paying attention to these city elections. And yet suddenly they become kind of the center of everything. You know, I talked to Sobel about this, and she has her own theory that she shared today. And let's listen to that. So Sobel's take is that the authorities are just afraid of destroying this myth that the opposition has no support among the population. So if they score an election victory, that somehow crashes down this idea that just 1 or 2% of the population are interested in what they have to say. And that's something that's being pushed through state media here as well.
So as we look ahead to this weekend, there's another protest scheduled for tomorrow. What should we expect? Because I've seen some Russian celebrities have been speaking out, something they don't usually do.
Yeah, again, I mean, we see what started off as a discussion about letting candidates on to a local race sort of spiral into this big political crisis. We've got some very high-profile Russian celebrities and kind of tastemakers coming out. You know, the general message seems to be that even if you don't support these candidates, you can't stand by while the police are beating and imprisoning your people.
And how have Moscow city officials reacted to all of this?
Well, it's a mix. It's a mix of fear and distractions, really. They've used scare tactics. There's selective repressions. We've seen a handful of these criminal cases that are grinding into the courts now. But in terms of the distractions, the city mayor has managed to pull together these big music food festivals out of thin air the last couple of weeks. They bounced another one for this weekend that's called Meet and Beat.
Meet, like not M-E-E-T, M-E-A-T?
That's the problem. It's designed to distract from the meeting M-E-E-T and M-E-A-T. So it's another food festival called Meet and Beat. So between trying to keep people off the street by scaring them with the possibilities of fine or imprisonment, and then having these other events to kind of attract them into the parks, they're trying to keep people away from these events altogether.
I mean, it does feel really local, partly because neither Putin nor the Kremlin have commented on the protests. What would you say is the connection between these protests and Putin?
Well, again, I mean, they started off what seemed to be such a small issue, trying to get access to the ballot. And yet suddenly it seems to be about what rights do people have in Russia? Do you have the right, the freedom to assembly? Do you have the right to choose your candidates? And I think for some people, it was pulling back the curtain on what the limits of political freedoms are in Russia today. So in that sense, it does concern Putin. And it's also reminiscent of a crackdown in 2012. The difference is that people don't seem quite as intimidated today, at least not yet.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're entering the sixth day of a blackout in Kashmir, a complete shutdown on all communications imposed by Narendra Modi, the Hindu nationalist prime minister of India. There is no fighting between India and Pakistan. Pakistan ruled out military action yesterday. But the blackout alone has terrorized Kashmir, a territory that's majority Muslim, and also raised questions around the world about what it means to regulate communications. David Kay is the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Opinion and Expression. Let's start with what's happening in Kashmir, a complete communications blackout. How concerned are you?
No, I'm very concerned. I mean, I would put it in two different contexts. One context is that governments around the world have been increasingly using their power over telecommunications and the internet simply to shut down the accessibility of the internet, of mobile communications and other sources for several years, and it's been only getting worse. In the context of Kashmir, the issue today is that India has not only shut down the internet, but has really put a blackout on all communications in and out of Kashmir.
I mean, I think of recent communications blackouts in Sudan, but that was a government trying to stop protests from being organized. It's oppressive for sure, but it did follow a pattern. Is there a precedent for what's happening in Kashmir?
You know, I've been trying to think about different precedents here. It's certainly clear that, like Sudan, in this particular case, it seems that India was acting in a way to actually preempt the ability of Kashmiris to engage in public protest. That kind of activity is not, unfortunately, is not abnormal these days. The difference here is just the extent and the nature of this this total shutdown. It's really quite unusual for a country that portrays itself as the world's largest democracy to do this kind of thing.
Do Kashmiris have any other options at this point?
Well, this is where it's been very troubling. It's been very hard to get information out of Kashmir. Kashmiris have very limited options for communications once the government has interfered with the telecommunications so severely. In fact, it's been very hard to get information from people on the ground in Kashmir. Many, many people, if not most people, cannot get access even to tools like Twitter, which is a real important tool for many people in Kashmir in terms of their organizing, their communications. It's even been extraordinarily difficult for people outside of Kashmir to be in touch with their families. So this has been quite a draconian approach to communications by the Indian government.
And it was enacted so quickly. Could this happen so easily elsewhere?
I think it could, unfortunately. Other countries could easily do this, in particular because they have the power over the telecommunications networks. I mean, they have contractual arrangements with them, and we've seen this in many, many parts of the world.
Could it happen here in the United States?
Well, it certainly could happen. I don't know if it would be as technically possible because of the extent of our telecommunications network and the constitutional issues and so forth. But certainly the technical power to interfere with communications is there.
David Kaye, I'd also like to ask you about, since you're the UN Special Rapporteur on Free Speech, about hate speech and specifically 8chan. That's the internet platform where the El Paso gunman uploaded his manifesto before killing 22 people. And that manifesto got rapidly reproduced on 8chan. 8chan got kicked off Cloudflare, its host, but the killer's manifesto is still out there. How do we go about regulating something like 8chan? Where do we even begin?
It's very difficult to regulate any of these platforms by government, particularly in the United States. I mean, in the United States, we have the First Amendment, and there's also human rights protections. Human rights law protects everyone's right to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas of all kinds. Typically speaking, if we're talking about incitement to violence and incitement to hatred, that's relatively easy to regulate in the sense that government has the authority to restrict incitement to violence. Beyond that, it's very difficult. We're also, I think, at a moment where we're confused about who should be responsible for regulating that content. Should it be the companies that have massive power over public debate and are making a lot of money in gathering up all of our content? Or should it be government that has government and public accountability at stake here? I don't think we've fully come to terms with how we want to regulate this kind of content.
David Kaye is the UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Opinion and Expression. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
The latest outbreak of the deadly Ebola virus has been concentrated in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the DRC. You might think a logical response from a worried neighbor like Rwanda would be to close the border to try to keep the virus out. But as we're about to hear, that can actually make matters worse. The World's Alana Gordon has the latest news on the virus and how officials are dealing with the open border between Rwanda and the DRC.
The Ebola virus has largely been isolated to remote areas of the DRC. But in mid-July, the outbreak hit a new level of concern. It reached the big city of Goma. There have been two Ebola deaths there. Goma is a major transit hub. It's 4.5 miles from neighboring Rwanda, and tens of thousands of people cross there every day. The introduction of the Ebola virus in Goma led to mounting panic that this very busy border would be closing.
Everyone is on edge. This border guard is making sure these people join the queue.
That's a report from Al Jazeera. Both sides, in Rwanda and the DRC, added hand-washing stations and health checks. But there were also backlogs in people crossing and reports that the border had been temporarily closed at one point. This week, the two countries met to discuss Ebola for the very first time. Dr. Ibrahima Sose Fall was there. He oversees the World Health Organization's Ebola response efforts in the DRC.
So this was really a very important meeting, at high-level meeting, because you have ministers from both countries leading their delegation to agree on some clear principle on how to collaborate together to prevent and control Ebola.
Dr. Fall says that closing borders to neighboring countries could actually make the situation worse. People may turn to informal paths to get back and forth. That could make it even harder to screen people crossing the border and find possible cases. But the DRC's border with Rwanda isn't the only concern. The DRC is ringed by countries.
That's why we have, since the beginning of the outbreak, considered South Sudan, Burundi, and Uganda as high-risk countries.
He says 24 Ebola cases have been detected at different DRC border points since the outbreak began last year. And that's why the lessons from this week are all the more important.
Instead of, you know, border closure, the most important thing is really information sharing on progress, challenges, and way forward.
At least 1,800 people have died of the virus since the outbreak began a year ago. That includes about 500 kids. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
News headlines are about a minute away. You're listening to The World. After 20 years of Vladimir Putin in power, we explore how the man in charge has consolidated and held on to power for two decades. Also, protesters pack Hong Kong's airport as passengers get off their flights. And atomic vodka from Chernobyl?
It's a moonshine, but it's a high-quality moonshine. It's different. It has more flavor.
Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. We were talking earlier on the show about the growing protests and unrest in Moscow. More demonstrations are planned for this weekend, supporting opposition candidates who've been barred from running in local elections. But the protests aren't just about Moscow elections. They're also about corruption. Protesters are also quietly focused on the man who controls the Kremlin, President Vladimir Putin. For the next few minutes, we're also going to focus on Putin, and today is a milestone in that respect. Putin has been in power for exactly 20 years. To help us understand how he got here, I'm joined by The World's Lucy Martirosian.
So, Marco, all of this started in 1999, but before we go there, I want to start with this. Okay, so can you guess what sport this is? I'll give you a hint. It's Vladimir Putin in a gym.
All right, that was definitely not ice hockey, which he loves. Wrestling or karate or something?
It's judo.
Ah, okay.
It's a form of martial arts originally from Japan. It's Putin's favorite. And this is him sparring with the Russian Olympic team in 2014 in Sochi.
Right. I think I've seen photos of him doing judo, along with photos of Putin topless and hunting and on horseback, all that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. A strong man. Angela Stent had a book out this year. It's called Putin's World.
The sport that enabled him to break or rise above his rather difficult childhood and his indifferent school performance was judo. He's a judo champion. He's a judo master. He's even written books about that.
And this is one of the reasons Stent says why Putin likes the sport so much.
One of the attributes of that is that even if you're physically weaker than your opponent, you can take advantage of their distraction, of their own weaknesses, and move in, you know, while they're not paying attention.
Yeah, so watch my left hand, and then he chops you in the neck with his right hand.
Yeah, pretty much. I bring it up because I think this is going to help us with what we're about to hear. Putin's 20-year timeline in Russia.
On August 9th,
1999, then-Russian President Boris Yeltsin appointed a veteran Soviet spy, Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin, as Russia's acting prime minister. Yeltsin had just fired his entire cabinet. Not only that, his health was deteriorating, and he was an alcoholic.
So when Putin came in, he was such a contrast to Yeltsin. He was young. He appeared to be fit. He was kind of almost monosyllabic in the beginning. He was very quiet and withdrawn. Obviously, he changed after that.
But even though Putin was healthier and younger than Yeltsin, nobody knew who he was. People didn't know if they could trust him.
I never heard that anybody from former KGB would be any close to this team.
Andrei Ilarionov is Putin's former economic advisor. He's now a senior researcher at the libertarian think tank, the Cato Institute in Washington. It was unheard of that a director of Russia's National Intelligence Service, the FSB, would someday be leading the country. The Legislative Duma officially voted Putin in on August 16th. Within a month, Russia was thrown into a crisis. A series of bombs exploded in apartment buildings in three major cities, including Moscow. More than 200 people died. Putin blamed Chechen rebels for the attacks. The Russian army had been at war with separatists in the region of Chechnya. The apartment bombings gave Putin a reason to start a second war.
It was obviously a bloody war, and during that time, the way that the forces from Moscow, the Russian army, finally prevailed over the insurgents was by leveling the capital, Grozny, much in the same way as we can see Russia and the Syrians have done in Syria. So that was something that we were following very carefully. It was very controversial.
Angela Stent was working as a Russia specialist for the State Department at the time. She was watching closely as Putin promised to avenge the bombings. He said, if authorities find terrorists at the airport, they'll get them at the airport. If they find them on the toilet, they'll get them on the toilet. People liked that. It made them feel safe. Putin's approval rating surged. But these apartment bombings were suspicious. After a fifth bomb was discovered, three FSB agents were arrested for allegedly putting it there. Some journalists reported that the bombings may have been orchestrated by the Russian government. Some people who made these claims would later be killed. On May 7th, 2000, Vladimir Putin was inaugurated president of Russia for the first time. Yeltsin had resigned. It was Putin's chance to reassert Russia as a great power. Russia had suffered a financial meltdown 2 years before. There was political chaos, and the country hadn't gone over the breakup of the Soviet Union. Russia was on its knees, and Putin is the one credited with saving it. Andrei Ilarionov helped in his advisory role. He says Putin repaid Russia's debt and doubled its GDP in just 10 years.
It is necessary to admit that at least that time, it was a very clear demonstration of how he was interested in understanding economic issues, in implementing rational economic policy. And that is why it was very comfortable to work with him, because he turned out to be best students in economics that I ever had in my life.
Russia was soon thriving. It was exporting more gas to Europe. It joined the G8, the group of eight highly industrialized nations. Ilarionov was Putin's personal representative at those meetings.
In the year 2000, he was ready to embrace West. Putin himself on record said several times that he would like to see Russia as a member of NATO.
Of course, it wasn't perfect. Putin refused help from the West during another disaster in 2000. The nuclear-powered submarine, the Kursk, sank in the Barents Sea. All 118 personnel on board died. Some critics say that Putin was too proud to ask the international community for help. Russia's biggest independent news channel, NTV, also criticized the Putin administration for the way it handled the disaster. A year later, the Kremlin took over almost all independent news media in Russia.
Security guards were placed around Russia's last independent national TV station.
It was the beginning of the end of democracy there. But the relationship between the U.S. and Russia was good, probably at its highest point in all of Putin's years. He met President George W. Bush for the first time.
I looked the man in the eye. I found it to be very straightforward and trustworthy. We had a very good dialogue. I was able to get a sense of his soul.
When 9/11 happened 3 months later, Russia was one of the first countries to reach out to America in its time of need. Within a few weeks, Putin was in the U.S. visiting Bush at his ranch in Crawford, Texas.
It brought rain, for which we're always grateful in the state of Texas.
Apparently, the Russians were amazed by how modest this ranch was. And this is when they're all sitting around and square dancing and saying, you know, we're partners together in this fight against terror. Because we really were, at that point, allies. We had a common enemy defeating the Taliban. Things began to sour almost immediately in December of 2001, when the United States pulled out of the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty.
The United States of America is withdrawing from this almost 30-year-old treaty.
The radical change has happened in year 2003.
It was just over 90 minutes beyond President Bush's deadline for Saddam Hussein to leave Iraq.
Under heavy bombardment on the day the war started.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people.
That was the crucial point. And for the year and a half before that time, Mr. Putin himself, as well as many other people from the Russian team, were trying to persuade our American counterpartners that it is wrong to attack Iraq.
Maybe Putin was disappointed, even outraged. But there were a lot of lessons here for him, too. He realized that foreign intervention was an option, that you could get away with it, as he did in Syria, Ukraine, and before that, the Republic of Georgia.
When he attacked Georgia in year 2008, so he used exactly the same explanation. Okay, if it is possible for you in Iraq, why it is not possible for me in Georgia?
Ilarionov says Putin changed his attitudes inside Russia, too. He went after the richest oligarch, Mikhail Khodorkovsky, a critic of his administration.
Once Russia's richest man, imprisoned Kremlin critic and former oil magnate.
It became clear rather fast, I would say, certainly everything in relative terms, that Mr. Putin, having been a very strong proponent of economic reforms and of rational economic policies, at that same time, it means not later, not earlier, at exactly the same time, was not a very big fan of democracy, human rights.
What made Ilarionov really sick to his stomach was the way Putin handled a school hostage crisis in southern Russia. It was September 1st, 2004. Beslan celebrated back to school day. It would sound something like this. Parents came with their children. The kids were dressed up in their best clothes. They held bouquets of flowers that they would give to their teachers. They sang the Russian national anthem. It was like every September 1st in Russia. Until it wasn't. Chechen rebels laid siege to the school. The terrorists held more than 1,000 children, parents, and school faculty hostage for 3 days in the auditorium. Mines surrounded the school. And when special operations forces stormed the site, it exploded.
Out of more than 1,000 people, 334, if I'm not mistaken, have been killed, murdered, and burned alive in that school. Yes, and that's a very clear demonstration of the attitudes towards people's life, what is important and what's not important. So that is why that was absolutely critical decision for me. Personally, I could not work anymore for the person who gave such an order.
The European Court of Human Rights ruled that Russia could have done more to prevent the loss of life. A year later, Ilarionov resigned as Putin's economic advisor. At a news conference, he said that Russia was no longer a free country, that things radically changed. After the brief war with Georgia, America's new president, Barack Obama, attempted to improve relations with Russia.
We resolved to reset U.S.-Russian relations.
But he failed. Putin had found a loophole to stay in power. He could switch back and forth from prime minister to president. And when Putin planned to do his infamous switch a second time in 2012, it created unrest in the country. but it didn't topple him. At the Sochi Winter Olympics in 2014, Putin could show the world the best parts of Russia. He asked Russians to smile and be warm to tourists. This was his chance to prove how great Russia was. But 3 days after the end of the Sochi Games, Russia invaded Crimea, a part of Ukraine, and then annexed it. This is when its relationship with the West shattered. According to Human Rights Watch, Putin's Russia today is more repressive than it's ever been in the post-Soviet era. There's a tight control on freedom of expression. LGBTQ people are often tortured or killed. Life for Russia's neighbors and enemies can be scary. Dozens of opposition activists and journalists have already been killed, jailed, or exiled. Putin's ability to stay in power is impressive and calculated, says Angela Stent.
He has managed to create a system where the people who surround him are all dependent on him. They're dependent on him for their jobs, for the assets that they have. So he's created a system where he sits at the top of a pyramid, and that people closer to the top of the pyramid believe that if he's no longer atop the pyramid, you know, they're not quite sure what's going to happen to them.
But Andrei Ilarionov says it's more personal than that.
He has put himself into the dead end. He could not leave the top position of the Russian power, regardless how that top position would be called, president, prime minister, national leader, national Führer, whatever. So he just cannot leave. And he cannot leave not only because nobody allows him to do it. No, from his personal psychology, he thinks that soon he leave that position, it would be extremely dangerous for him, because in a dictatorship, nobody can ensure his property and life.
Lucy Martirosyan, is that true? I mean, could Putin's life be in danger if he leaves his rule in Russia?
We don't know for sure. Putin may have well been thinking about this early on when he extended protections to Yeltsin and his family in the 90s. It seems that every action Putin makes is extremely calculated.
Right, like his favorite sport, judo.
Right, like in judo. There's been speculation about what he might do after his presidential term ends in 2024. Maybe in 5 years he'll resign and announce a successor, one of his oligarch friends, or he could choose to somehow remove limits on the president post or remove it altogether so that he could stay in power longer as prime minister. And remember, Marco, he remains popular in Russia.
So you've showed us how the relationship between Russia and the U.S. deteriorated since George W. Bush, but Trump speaks even more warmly of Putin than Bush. I mean, isn't the relationship improving in some ways?
I think Putin was hoping for that, but he still doesn't really understand the United States and government here. There are irreversible wounds with Russia, and even if Trump can look past Putin's human rights abuses and war crimes, Congress can't. And that might be a detail that he overlooked. As Andrei Ilarionov told me, it might be too late for Putin to ever understand the West, and vice versa.
The World's Lucy Martirosyan, thank you very much for this.
Thanks, Marco.
We've got a timeline of major events from Putin's 20 years in power at theworld.org. A handwritten sign on a bedsheet read, "Sorry for the inconvenience, we are fighting for the future of our home." The apology is from the thousands of protesters staging a 3-day sit-in at Hong Kong's International Airport.
We want to spread our message to the world, to the U.S. or to Europe, any country that might help us internationally.
And if you want to get some international attention, what better place to gather than at one of the world's busiest airports? The movement in Hong Kong began as a protest against a bill that would have allowed Hong Kong residents to be extradited to mainland China. The movement has since spread. Hong Kong protesters are now demanding more freedom and greater democracy. The BBC's Martin Yip is in Hong Kong and has been covering the story.
This one so far has been peaceful because the organizers do set some rules to themselves, just like not to storm the restricted area, the security area, and not to storm the runway. That would cause maximum disruption, but obviously that would be illegal. So they definitely have to consider if this would cause any further backfire.
Martin, have there been additional police dispatched to the airport? How are authorities reacting to these masses of people showing up?
I don't think there are significant increase of police presence. And actually, these protesters did not apply for a so-called license from the police force. So if the police would actually move in, it would be quite obvious. Also, since it's a place where thousands of people arrive every hour from across the world, if there would be police presence, just like any other protest sites, it's quite easy to spark. So I would imagine even the police force would want to think twice before they try to clear out the protesters.
It has been 10 straight weekends of protests now in Hong Kong. You've been covering the story since the protest broke out, Martin. What strikes you about where things stand now with the demonstrations?
I think it's really about how the protesters and those who are against the protesters are torn apart. You really have people who don't support the campaign, believing in all sorts of rumors. Say, for example, they all believe these anti-government protesters are paid to do the job. They don't believe anyone are actually doing any civic campaign out of their own consciousness.
What do you think that suggests about the sustainability of these protests? Can they go on if there is this kind of tearing apart from the inside?
I think this simply adds to the uncertainty of whether these campaigns could go on. But the other possibility is that since the campaigns are not organized by any organizer, they just organize among themselves, they could always change, and they always try to borrow a phrase from the late martial art superstar Bruce Lee.
Be formless, shapeless, like water. Now, water can flow, or it can crash. Be water, my friend.
Be water, my friend. So just move around to different places to protest, such as from one police station to the other. And this time you see them at the airport. So you just don't know for the coming up days if they would also shift to different places to keep the campaign going.
The BBC's Martin Yip in Hong Kong. Thanks very much for your time.
Welcome.
Craft, microbrews, and specialty liquors may be all the rage these days, but there's one new vodka that really takes it up a notch. Atomic Vodka is made from grain and water from, wait for it, the Chernobyl Exclusion Zone. It'll be the first consumer product to come from the area since the nuclear reactor catastrophe in 1986. Don't worry, though. We're told the vodka's safe to drink. Jim Smith is a professor at the University of Portsmouth in the UK. He led the team of scientists that distilled the vodka as part of a 3-year research project.
So I started studying the Chernobyl accident in 1990 when I did my PhD. And I started working in Ukraine and Belarus in about 1994. So we've done various projects since then. But this is probably, for me, the most exciting one. About 3 years ago, we decided to look at the transfer of radioactivity into crops within the exclusion zone. That's the area that was evacuated of about 4,000 square kilometers around the site after the accident.
And what did you find out about radiation transfer to plants and crops?
The important thing to know is that radioactivity in the exclusion zone varies a lot. There's a few hot spots, but in the rest of the exclusion zone, a large proportion of radiation is no different than what you might get in some areas of elevated natural radiation, like Colorado in the States, parts of India, parts of the UK. So that means that if you made bread from grain and ate it, it wouldn't necessarily be dangerous, but it would be a slightly elevated risk.
So how did brewing vodka become part of the project?
Well, we thought we've got this grain, let's do something with it. So we fermented it and distilled it to make alcohol. As every chemist knows, if you distill something, a lot of the impurities in it stay in the waste product and very few get through the final product. So when we distilled it 3 times, we couldn't find any Chernobyl radioactivity in the final product.
So this vodka has a label called Atomic Vodka, as I said. You even have a company now, the Chernobyl Spirit Company. I got to say, it does feel a bit like a gimmick tied to a tragedy, but the Chernobyl Spirit Company does plan to donate 75% of the profits back to the recovering communities around Chernobyl. I mean, how much money would that actually raise for the people of Chernobyl?
Well, that's something we're very aware of. If you go to the exclusion zone now, you go to the entry point where all the tourists go. There's some kiosks selling, to me, what are quite tasteless things with sort of skulls on and radioactive symbols and things. That's what we're trying to avoid, really. I mean, we genuinely are trying to do this to support the local communities, to bring some investment into the area. The first year, we're aiming for a few hundred bottles, which isn't going to change very much. But we hope that in the future, this might grow. People might want to buy and try this vodka, and we can make some significant profits to support the local abandoned lands where people are still living and unemployment's high. People can't use the land. So we want to start helping support that.
Finally, Jim, the key question, how does atomic vodka taste? I assume you've tasted it.
I have tasted it, yeah. It's a moonshine, but it's a high-quality moonshine. We really like what we've produced. We did a tasting at the State Agency of Ukraine for Exclusion Zone Management, who we're working with on this project. Their bosses tasted it, and they know their vodka. And what they said was that it doesn't taste like a standard vodka, but they really liked it. It has more flavor. At the moment, it's very limited. We've only got one bottle at the moment, but we are hoping to begin small-scale production.
Well, even if it tastes like moonshine, I still have to say Nazdarovi.
Thank you.
Jim Smith is a professor at the University of Portsmouth in the UK. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And that will take care of business this Friday. Our theme music was written by Ned Porter. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you all on Monday.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.